and I woke up late. Didn't even have a shower. Lunch break, give me a break. A damn half an hour.
Scheduled Muhammad.
For 12 bucks an hour. Plug me to Chuck D. Wanna fight the power. Instead, I like the style before I go in the morning. Being here 8 hours, sure, get you nauseous. Lady across from me, telling me a problem. I'm looking at her like, yo, how the fuck I'm gonna solve it? You know our ethnicity, car, no rent, don't forget electricity. Internet, cable, and the phone all connected. Full gas, tolls, all now it's getting hacked. Brand new clothes, now you rather see me naked, yo, check it.
The article I wanted to get to on entrepreneurship. Let's see if I can find this. We lost two giants. I want to talk about two great ones in a minute. While I was off air, two absolute giants passed away. Giants. I don't use that word lightly. How hard could it be? I'm going to read this article from Inc. Magazine. How hard could it be? Talking about starting a business. It says a new business is like a shortwave radio. You have to fiddle patiently with all the dials until you get the reception you want. It's something that we in marketing call it not ready, fire, aim. Pardon me, not ready, aim, fire, but actually ready, fire, aim. Like you learn how to shoot by missing. This article talks about that. Let me read some of it. We sent this out of show prep. If you read too many of those books found in the business section at the airport bookstore, you know, the kind that tell you the story of Amazon or Dell or Google or Starbucks and how it zigged where everyone else was zagging and how this led to magnificent riches, you start to notice a pattern. Virtually all the companies you see profiled are huge successes, with the minor exception of a few spectacularly huge failures that are so spectacular and so huge that they're just doggone fun to read about, Enron and whatnot. This is Joel Spolsky of Inc. Magazine. He says, the problem is that trying to cope or copy one company's model is a fool's errand. This song sounds hot. This is Ben Harper. Damn, underpaid concubine. Lay there and hate me. I had to watch what this song is about. Lay there and hate me. I'm going to keep my eye open on this. Goodness gracious. The problem is that trying to copy one company's model is a fool's errand. It's hard to figure out what part of the Starbucks formula made this business a smash hit while so many of its rivals failed. Starbucks' success is the product of a combination of factors that came together in precisely the right way at precisely the right time. It's nearly impossible to isolate which one was the most important. You would probably have to look at the hundreds of small coffee chains that didn't make it big before you stood a chance of seeing what really distinguished Starbucks. Okay, sing Ben Harper. Blow, brother. Eight-page letter. Goodness, this is the blues right here. This is like B.B. King meets Jimi Hendrix and Lenny Kravitz. Singing the blues. Okay, brother. Ben Harper, I approve of this album. This album is hotter than Eminem's. Lay There and Hate Me is the name of this song. Back to the article. In investing, the phenomenon of looking too closely at success and not at all at failure is known as survivorship bias. For example, if you read somewhere that the average investment fund returned 8.3%, and I just made that up, you need to remember that the calculation most likely excludes all the funds that lost so much that they closed down. The survivorship bias in entrepreneurship was on my mind a few months ago. My company was putting together a conference in Boston, and I invited my friend Jessica Livingston to speak. Jessica is the co-founder of a small angel investment group called Y Combinator. Okay, man. Singing the blues. This is the new album, White Lies for Dark Times, Ben Harper. Y Combinator. Its model is to give a few thousand dollars to groups of two or three geeks to start tech companies. She has also written a book called Founders at Work, in which she interviews the founders of about 30 successful startups. When she asked me what she should speak about, I asked her to consider describing all the different ways a startup can fail, rather than the usual stuff about lessons learned from people who succeeded. All right, listen up. Speaking to Entrepreneur, Small Business Nation, my core constituency. That would be boring, she told me. They all fail for the same reason. People just stop working on their business. Yeah, well, sure, most people die because their heart stops beating. But somehow dying in different ways is still interesting enough to support 40 hours a week of primetime programming. But the more I thought about it, the more I realized Jessica was onto something. Why do startups fail? As she pointed out, it's usually a collapse of motivation. Everyone wanders back to civilian life, and the startup ends not with a bang, but a whimper. Now, this is heavy. I got two chapters that deal with this right here. This is a monster. Why do startups fail? As she pointed out, it's usually a collapse of motivation. Everyone wanders back to civilian life, and the startup ends not with a bang, but a whimper. I have a chapter on team. I mentioned it earlier, how to build your team. Lessons that I learned in business and through observations and deep study. But I was in a business relationship with someone, it was very profitable, with someone who really wanted to work more than they wanted to have their own thing. They lost their job and they became what I call a necessity-driven entrepreneur. A necessity-driven entrepreneur. A person who has to go into business because they have nothing else to fall back on. These people are dangerous. They could be your best ally, or they could be the worst kind of illusion that you could ever encounter. There are many people who right now, and even in the sound of my voice, losing their jobs or who are about to lose their jobs, they really don't want to have their own thing. They just want to have another job. So if you start a business with someone who has just lost their job and their heart is still in their profession, they want to reclaim the status and the title that they lost, be careful. Be careful. Next opportunity they have to get a job, maybe an offer too good to pass up on in their eyes. Be careful who you start businesses with. Very talented, skilled people you can pull resources with, but they have to have the heart to endure this personal struggle and sacrifice that entrepreneurship is about. I have a chapter on this, as well as a chapter on how entrepreneurship affects relationships, personal relationships. So this is big. This person is saying they all fail for the same reason. People just stop working on their business. Why do startups fail? As she pointed out, it's usually a collapse of motivation. Everyone wanders back to civilian life, and the startup ends not with a bang, but a whimper. The secret to this, which this article really doesn't get to, and I'll keep reading it. Hold on, Ben Harper. This is called Why Must You Always Dress in Black? You broke down in history, doesn't mean you're really all that smart. Okay, that didn't rhyme, but that was hot. Like Robert E. Lee and Joe Mess. How much you always dress in black? Now back to this article about how hard could it be to start a business. There's something that you can't do for your business partners, which is the horns of the dilemma, the crux that you're in. You can't motivate them. In the quiet of their mind, when the person, prospective partner, is alone, or they have loved ones, family members, and other relationships they're involved in, the risk that they are taking, the hardship, the difficulties, and the sacrifice, it begins to weigh on their mind, and you're not around. And if this person cannot motivate themselves, doesn't know how to strengthen their willpower through things like prayer, affirmation, visualization, you are in trouble. Let me tell you. And they'll go back and get a job. Nothing wrong with that. My point is, there are some very, they're actually kind of like, they're sincere. They think they're ready, but they're not. And this is actually one of the ways that people are tied to the old system. It will take mass firings and layoffs before people will actually accept that there may not be another job available to them at the level that they are accustomed to. Many people are finding that out now. Let me continue with the article. It says here, Paul Graham, Jessica's husband and partner in Y Combinator, has tackled this subject on his website. The biggest reason founders stop working on their startups is that they get demoralized. He writes, some people seem to have unlimited self-generated morale. These almost always succeed. At the other extreme, there are people who seem to have no ability to do this. They need a boss to motivate them. In the middle, there is a large band of people who have some but not unlimited ability to motivate themselves. These can succeed through careful morale management and some luck. So who is capable of careful morale management, and what does it entail? In my mind, an entrepreneur is like a kid playing with his first shortwave radio. He takes it home and turns it on, and what does he hear? Nothing, static. This might be demoralizing, so he tries a different frequency. Nothing, static. And this might be demoralizing again until his mom wanders by and plugs in the antenna on the radio, and suddenly he picks up the ghost of a station. It sounds like it's far away, and they seem to be speaking. What is the language they're speaking? Never mind, it's a station, an antenna. Who knew? The kid runs off to blog about how cool antennas are. That is what it's like when you're creating a business. There's an initial burst of excitement when you come up with the idea, and another surge in momentum when you make your first few sales. At this point, you're so dang cocky that you have too much wine at Thanksgiving dinner and pointedly remind your mother-in-law about how rude she was to dismiss your startup idea, and how, when you're making millions of dollars, there will be nothing for her. She can bloody well eat frozen government cheese. But as the business progresses, you start trying to turn all the various knobs on your fancy radio set in order to get better reception or to find a station you like. And fortunately in business, we founders have a lot of knobs to play with. There's price, location, employees, marketing, advertising, return policies, trade shows, products, search engine optimization, and every item in your budget. Say you decide to open a restaurant. You rent space, fill it with tables, stock the kitchen, and hire a bunch of waiters and a host to seat people and answer phones and take reservations. And then on the night of your grand opening, imagine the sound of crickets here. Nobody comes. At this moment, a founder who is incapable of careful morale management will think to himself, maybe a career in HR management isn't so bad after all. Meanwhile, the determined founder will start playing with the dials, rethinking the menu, trying new promotions, and adjusting prices. And what he'll find is that, just like the tuner on a radio, certain aspects of a business can be off by only a little bit, and then one tiny adjustment and bing, the thing starts working. Morale management. I'm feeling parts of this article. I write on this in my book. I've experienced it. I'm not just talking from theory. You gotta be careful who you partner with. Certain personality types. Some folks are coordinators. Some folks are gangsters. Some folks are hustlers. Some folks are natural born salespeople. Some folks are like neurotic, neurosis type engineers. All they want to do is work on the nitty gritty details. You gotta build your team accordingly. Let me pump some Ben Harper. I'll let that marinate. Skin Thin. This is Ben Harper, the new album, White Lies for Dark Times. Skin Thin. I like that one. There's about 5 songs on this album I'm feeling. Ben Harper. It's like blues. It's bluesy. With some Hendrix type flavor. Not too much. I don't want to exaggerate. Is this better than Lenny Kravitz? I don't know. Is that silly for me to make such a comparison? Let me give you one more. It's called Fly One. Oh no, Fly One Time. Fly One Time, Ben Harper. Album selling a little bit, top 10 album. White Lies for Dark Times. This is called Keep It Together So I Can Fall Apart. Maybe I like his lyrics too. He got something to say. See, I like that spatial dimension reverb as well.
Listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.
Now, if your business partners start singing this to you, you have a problem. Oh, be careful. You get into business with the wrong person. Not skill-wise, not character-wise, just motivation-wise. This article is talking about careful morale management. If you are in, and you could be in a relationship with someone like this too, but we're talking business. Money on the line. Deals pending. Capital working. Let me read you the key paragraph in this thing. Say you decide to start a restaurant. You rent space, fill it with tables, stock the kitchen, and hire a bunch of waiters. And you host, and you hire a host to seat people. And you answer the phone, take reservations. And then on the night of your grand opening, imagine the sound of crickets. This is what you hear instead of customers' plates clanging, knives and forks clinging. At this moment, a founder of a business who was incapable of careful morale management will think to himself or herself, maybe a career in HR management isn't so bad at all. Keep it together so I can fall apart.
Ending whackness in the name of blackness. You are listening to the Cedric Muhammad and Black Coffee Show only at blackcoffeechannel.com.
Tell them to come get CM Cap. CMCap.com. I'll be doing free consultations June 18th and the 25th, I believe. Two Thursdays from now. If you want a free consultation, sign up. CMCap.com. Can't wait for my book to come out. We will build on this deeply. The book deals with the political economy, the context of the entrepreneur operates politically, and in the broader context of the global economy. in terms of business principles, negotiating, developing your personal power, standardizing your business, and then what I just talked about, the personal struggle, suffering, personal relationships, and willpower. It's the longest section of the book. Got to keep it together so I can fall apart. This is what your business partners are telling you right now. You don't hear them, though. I heard them. June 3rd, 2009, CedricMuhammad.com, BlackCoffeeChannel.com, BlackElectorate.com, CMCap.com. It's my consulting firm, entrepreneurs, small business owners. Folks need business plans reviewed, capital raised. I do all of that. I'm going to devote much more time to that. Particularly in lieu of the book that I'm writing, the emphasis will be a lot on what we're talking about today, business principles, things that will help you think through, you know, reality a little bit better, in my view. I think the point I was trying to make earlier with the comment that President Obama made about why he doesn't watch the cable channels, I think it applies to all of us. I mean, how much time can you spend on political chatter when we're having economic problems? I mean, there's no balance. What I've been watching is international news, like I've been saying. Oh, he told me I'm out of the way of the camera. Hold on. Is that a little better? All right. Yeah, what I've been doing is international news. A lot of movies. I'm going to read to you all the list. I think I must have watched 15 movies over the break. I'm going to read to you those. One movie I broke down and cried. It was a boohoo cry. I had a boohoo cry. This wasn't the one I cried. This was a boohoo. Very embarrassing. I don't trust myself now with sentimental moments, touching things. And now that I'm hugging trees and communing with nature on the regular, I really, you better stay away from me. I mean, let me tell you how in tune I am with the universe and natural law. I refuse to kill, it was an ant or something, clearly in my domain. I ushered that ant out to its own environment. What's happening to me? Am I turning into a green activist? This is called The Word Suicide, Ben Harper. Good album. It's got a B.B. King kind of folksy feel. Little Hendrix-ism. We'll talk about Jimi Hendrix briefly. But we'll talk about it now. People saying that Jimi Hendrix's manager may have killed him in order to collect on an insurance policy. I think the word was that man was already a British intelligence agent. That story's up at blackelectorate.com. So we just talked about it. I'll give you some Hendrix maybe a little later. Anyway, I don't know what I was talking about. But this year, more time on entrepreneurship and economics and geopolitics. Not domestic stuff that's meaningless. Not domestic news where they herd you into following one event a week. I have not watched CNN, Fox, MSNBC for 40 days. It's a beautiful thing. Consider giving it up. You don't have to every day hang on the edge of what's going on those three channels. You'll be okay. Watch your local news. Read your local newspaper or read a national newspaper like I do. Get out and walk in your neighborhood. Get involved. You'll be okay. I love what President Obama said about that. He does not learn anything from that chatter. He reads his national security briefings in 5 newspapers, he said. Do I need to play that part again? Maybe I'll play that again. My brother from another mother, Mark Double M from D.C., you know him. He sent me an article, something on China. Timothy the Godfather Geithner in China, talking real soft with a Chinese audience. Let me get him with the Chinese flag in back of him and the American flag showing love, peace, and harmony. The Godfather, Timothy Geithner. Let me show you all what's going on here with this. I want to read something from Wall Street Journal last week. Zachariah Carabel. That's the, I give the Ben Harper album like 4 out of 5 whatevers. 4 out of 5 crescents. Something like that, if we were to do that. The Eminem album, again, if you missed it, I played it. Hot beats. Great lyrics. Or great lyrical delivery. Eminem is a all-time great rapper. If you want to argue with me, comment at blackcoffeechannel.com. Email me, comment at blackcoffeechannel.com. Eminem, a top 25 all-time rapper, no doubt. But, you know, you have to be into someone talking about popping pills and having suicidal thoughts. And it's just 10 years of that is enough. He needs to become a talk show host. Shock jock. Now, maybe that's the next career for Eminem. All those attributes may carry over quite well for him. This op-ed is called Why Beijing Wants a Strong Dollar by Zachariah Carabel. It says, 20 years ago, in the wake of the suppression of the student movement that had taken over Tiananmen Square, it seemed as if China's brief opening to the world had come to an end. In fact, 1989 marked the beginning of China's supercharged path to economic reform. And the results have been tremendous. China is now the second pillar of the global economy and is increasingly vital given the vulnerability of the United States. The U.S. now relies on China for credit, a fact that is generating considerable anxiety in Washington and Beijing. Last month, Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao called for more international oversight of the world's major reserve currencies. While he didn't specifically mention the U.S. dollar, the mention or the message was clear. As the largest holder of U.S. debt, the Chinese government is restless as the $2 trillion in foreign reserves it holds fluctuates primarily based on the management or mismanagement of American financial institutions. Mr. Wen's comments, as well as more recent statements by other Chinese officials, constitute a series of not-so-subtle hints by China that it intends to take a more active approach toward its substantial investments in the U.S. Given that China is now the largest holder of U.S. treasuries and the largest foreign creditor of the U.S. government to the tune of approximately $1 trillion in government securities alone, the recent statements by Chinese officials have caused serious American trepidation. Okay, you've restated the problem. Let's get to what you're saying. The most commonly expressed fear is that China could use its status as the largest foreign creditor to pressure the U.S. to take positions it would not otherwise take. What if China wants to adopt a harsher stance towards Taiwan? Or what if it refuses to pressure North Korea to halt its nuclear arms program? To many, that fear seemed justified when Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, who will be in China next week, now remember, he's in China now, this was written last week, recently refused to label China a currency manipulator. This led to an immediate outcry on the part of Charles Schumer and Lindsey Graham that the administration was succumbing to Chinese pressure. That in turn fueled the already rampant speculation that China now holds the equivalent of a sword of Damocles over the U.S. Do what we say or we will dump your bonds. While this is a rare... He's spent like half his op-ed restating what we already know. Which is good. It's good to review. But here he go. Here's his point. To begin with, China cannot simply decide one day to dump its bonds and torpedo the U.S. economy. It can't even credibly threaten to do so because it has no one to sell them to. Ah, you're getting somewhere now, Zachary Carabel. What government could take the risk of further enmeshing itself in an American economy that is widely seen as having drawn the global system into an untenable dependence on low-grade debt? The German central bank certainly wouldn't, nor would Japan, which already holds hundreds of billions in U.S. debt. The sovereign wealth funds of the oil-rich Arab sheikdoms, including Saudi Arabia, let me floss with my pseudo-Arabic or Arab accent. Supposedly that makes you like more wiser. I know some of you all out there hard working on an Arab accent. Anyway, Saudi Arabia have already taken hits with their investments in U.S. financial institutions and are wary of further depreciation of their oil-dependent assets. But even if there were buyers, the issue is deeper than economics. China's investments in the U.S. are as much a political decision as an economic one. They represent the culmination of two decades of assiduous efforts on the part of the Chinese government and many U.S. companies to bind the two economies together. Family, this is just like USSR. The whole time that the Cold War was raging, they had something called the US-USSR Tech. It's a council, TEC. Rockefellers. They would all meet. All the companies were in harmony. White House would have these gatherings. There was always a direct relationship between the business elite of America and the business elite of Soviet Union. Same thing going on with China. To see China's holdings as a threat is to misjudge the goals of the Chinese government. China believes that its affluence is best guaranteed by economic interdependence with the world's most dynamic economy. It certainly wants to evolve so that its affluence is eventually comparable to that of America, but that is years away. And while there is a competitive component to China's ambitions, it is competition within the framework of capitalism more than nationalism. Now, I wrote something on my blog, CedricMuhammad.com, about how to build a reserve currency. I'm telling the reader that China knows they're far away from replacing the dollar in terms of any other alternative currency. Now, what will determine the new reserve currency, quite honestly, will be America's currency going into the toilet. It will not be other nations getting their act together. It won't be Africa coming up with a single currency first. It won't be the euro getting its act together. And it won't be China in and of its own efforts. The dollar will have to deteriorate and decay due to poor mismanagement, which is on the way. So whether the dollar falls in a year or whether it's 2 to 3 years, that's the window in which another currency would have to be established. But I like what China's doing. They're buying time while talking ish. Beautiful. Yeah, this is Joel Evans. So at CedricMuhammad.com, I wrote something a couple weeks ago, called How to Build a Reserve Currency, How China or Europe. Now, this is the key part to show you how far away China is. At some point, China will have to allow. It currently does not make its currency available on international currency markets. It will have to allow the renminbi to belong to the world. The fact that China's currency is not traded internationally, it's not internationally available, you can't convert it freely, that's what's holding China back, to be honest with you. China wants a world reserve currency other than the dollar so that they can take their money out of dollars. Now, Steve Hanke just wrote a column for Asian Global, I think, that he says China should put their money in gold. Or they should tie their own currency to gold. That's big. Steve Hanke is currency board guru. So Beijing, China does not really want the dollar to just fall like that. They're too tied to it. Now, in this blog that I wrote, I include an excerpt of an email exchange I had with Reuven Brenner of McGill University. And what China would have to do is the same thing that the Eurozone would have to do if the euro was to become a reserve currency. Here's what Reuven writes. He says, to achieve this outcome, the Eurozone countries would have to radically reform their fiscal and regulatory policies to encourage far more domestic entrepreneurship and consumption than they presently do. This scenario does not seem to be in the cards. And with China, here's what Reuven had to say. He says, as for China, yes, the currency swaps could work. China's been doing these currency swaps. You can read that at my blog. I don't want to get into that. It can get a little technical. But China and Brazil last month agreed to no longer use U.S. dollars in their trade with one another. But Ruben says, as for China, yes, the currency swaps could work, but the Chinese currency, for it to become a reserve currency, they would have to open up their internal economy and not bet on export-driven models. That's it right there. China currently has an export-driven model, as does most of Asia. The reason that China has this huge surplus of U.S. dollars is because China exports so much to the United States. The China domestic internal economy is not strong enough, or else Chinese consumers and entrepreneurs will be buying foreign goods. Trade balance would be in order. The way you get a reserve currency is that you spread your currency around the world by the people that live in your country buying other goods, sending that currency abroad. When you have an export-driven model, and this is part of my problem with the African economies, where you want to just sell everything that comes out of the earth and call that economic growth and development. You have countries depending upon oil, gold, minerals. That's all they have. Until you have a developed economy where entrepreneurs are purchasing foreign goods and consumers are buying foreign goods, you're going to have a surplus. Can't have a reserve currency like that. This is a big subject. I want to read an article about how this export-driven policy is seeing its last days in Asia. I want to thank my brother from another mother, Mark M., for making this subject come to light for me. He sent me an article yesterday at my Facebook page, which you all can log on to. Join my join the show's fan page on Facebook, and you can comment, etc. Hour number 5. Export-driven economic models have seen their last days. Timothy Geithner over in China talking real softly. This is partly why China and America need each other until there's a transition for a new country or block of nations to take America's place. It's already in the works. We'll be right back.
So I was sitting in my cubicle today, and I realized ever since I started working, every single day of my life has been worse than the day before it. So that means that every single day that you see me, that's on the worst day of my life.
What about today? Is today the worst day of your life?
Yeah.
Wow, that's messed up. I'm sorry. Go on.
Is there any way that you could sort of just zonk me out so that, like, I don't know that I'm at work in here? Could I come home and think that I've been fishing all day or something?
That's really not what I do, Peter. However, the good news is, I think I can help you.
Yeah, Cedric Muhammad.
I hate my boss, dude think he know it all. And I know it all, but I follow protocol. Hope he's sitting in the casket, got me sitting in traffic. It's 7 a.m. And I woke up late, didn't even have a shower. Lunch break, give me a break, a damn half an hour.
Cedric Muhammad.
For 12 bucks an hour, plug me to Chuck D. Wanna fight the power, instead I like the sound before I go in the office. Being here 8 hours, sure it gets you nauseous. Lady across from me, telling me a problem. I'm looking at her like, yo, I'm gonna solve it. You know our ethnicity, car note, rent, don't forget electricity. Internet, cable, and the phone all connected. Full gas, tolls, old nails, getting hacked. Brand new clothes, now you'd rather see me naked. Yo, check it, I got my check. Now I'm feeling disrespectful. Why am I working here? It ain't working here. It ain't worth it here. I'm never gonna persevere. Ain't no money for new shoes or purses here. Should've done my first career, huh? Nursing, yeah. Now I'm sitting here thinking about the work I put in. This birth from the everyday working woman. I put on my pants, put on my shoes. I pray to God, paid all my dues. I'm trying to win, seem like I was born to lose. All I can say, I say let me through, but they don't let me through. You wanna quit? Damn, I'm ready to. Red lifestyle I'm living, ain't steady. Not all I can say. Hey, yo, I'm looking for a job.
Ain't nobody hiring. Then I asked the boss, when y'all doing firing? You I'm admiring. Nice job, family man, car, and looking in his warm advertisement.
Should've
been a fireman. Learn to do wiring, then get retirement. I blame my environment. I'm on an interview, my delivery. Locked up, felony, that'll do quizzing me. You working on my future, why you need to know my history? All he did was Google me, no big mystery.
Shut
he ain't digging me, politely he was dissing me. No, we're not hiring, but thanks for the visit, please. He ain't want me, my grandmother warned me. Them damn felonies will haunt me, taunt me. No second chance, back to the same block. Go home, my baby mom and change locks. This game, I'm okay, the game's on. Open the door with the chain on. Since he been reaching out for several days, I ain't helping out, we need to go our separate ways. I'm just amazed, wanna go another route? Let me take my clothes, said she took them to my mother's house. She was store, yeah, P.O. and said go ahead and wild out, I call you P.O.
I put on my pants, put on my shoes. I pray to God, paid all my dues. I'm trying to win, seem like I was born to lose. All I can say, I say let me through, but they don't let me through. You wanna quit?
Quit.
Damn, I'm ready to. Ready. Lifestyle I'm living ain't steady.
Not at all.
All I can say.
Cedric Muhammad.
June 3rd, 2009.
Cedric Muhammad.
Yeah, this is big, big. I'm going to go a little further on this about why the Chinese currency is not ready yet to replace the dollar. And there's frustration. You can hear frustration in the voice. In the technique, strategy, and the tactics that the Chinese are using to kind of jawbone or talk the dollar down. They hate the fact that they still really depend on the dollar. Now, in the blog that I wrote, How to Build a Reserve Currency, I'm going to read this again. My exchange with Reuven Brenner. It says here, as for China, yes, the currency swaps could work, but for the Chinese currency to become a reserve currency, they would have to open up their internal economy and not bet on an export-driven model, giving up state control of domestic demand. Otherwise, how could the rest of the world accumulate their currency, allowing the yuan or yuan to become an international currency? For this to happen, the Communist Party must give up power. Now, the reason why Reuven is saying that is because most communist parties believe in state control of economics. Now, that can work for the benefit. Like, if you look at what's going on in Cuba, socialist country, money is directed toward healthcare, education, so they get that right. Haven't been able to get the currency right, though. And that's why the U.S. dollar is so popular in Cuba. Chavez in Venezuela still having a hard time getting the currency thing right. Gaddafi, Libya, same thing. So in order to have a real vibrant internal economy, you have to at some point develop entrepreneurs. This is my point about what's happening in distressed rural and urban areas in America. It's really not that much different. I'm going to go back to the first thing we talked about, and then I'm going to talk about Asia's export-driven economic model going out of fashion. Now, you go to Harlem. We talked about it earlier about the Costco, the lack of a Costco, lack of BJ's Wholesale, etc. That will take food stamps. In a sense, don't get me wrong. I don't want to make this too rigid of a comparison, but in a sense, you could compare the reliance of the Latino and black community on government to redistribute capital that we have in our pockets, but through consumption it leaves the community. You could liken that to a state-controlled economy in a foreign country, in that entrepreneurship is not valued. The way you solve the problem in Harlem of not having a Costco that will accept food stamps is you develop capable, skilled entrepreneurs and you finance them. And then they create an alternative to Costco right in the community. You accept food stamps and you've put Costco and BJ Wholesales out of business with your own community, providing a good product with a comparative advantage. You feel me? But if you won't back entrepreneurs, allow them to flourish, if you won't encourage them, if you won't give them seed capital, if you won't help them with technical assistance, and if you have a community that simply won't pool its wealth together, if it's poor, the only way to have scale is for a lot of people with a little to put it together and create volume. This is what the Jewish Free Loan Societies did, the Hu and Koi of the Japanese and Chinese culture, Isusu partners in Jamaican culture. It's why, part of the reason why I think Marcus Garvey was so successful, he was dealing with a highly skilled West Indian population. Okay, I say all that to say, the Chinese people have yet to develop the kind of economy from the bottom up as entrepreneurs and consumers that would naturally lead to a Chinese currency being spread throughout the world, because they would be buying foreign goods. As it stands now, Asia sends things around the world and accepts currency back. That's why there's so many dollars in China. All right, here's the article. Asia export policy goes beyond sell by date. This is from the May 27th Financial Times. Now that Westerners are busily building up their depleted savings, can export-dependent Asian economies adjust to a world in which the U.S. consumer is no longer the buyer of last resort? Economists are asking whether countries like China will be able to reorient their economies so that domestic demand becomes the main driver of growth. China should produce things for itself instead of acquiring sterile claims on the U.S., says Paul Krugman. Since it liberalized its economy 30 years ago, China has produced a vast amount of real goods, only some of which have gone to improve the standard of living of its own people. So the point is, China has an economy, but it produces for the world. It doesn't produce for its own. The same was true in Japan, whose spectacular post-war growth was engineered by bureaucrats who prioritized the welfare of exporters through currency, tax, and environmental standards policy over that of consumers. The Japanese famously paid more for made-in-Japan goods than people buying them abroad. So the Japanese government, coming out of the war, they gave preferential treatment to exporters, people who were selling goods around the world. And you know, that had a lot to do with the Americans who were influencing the planning of Japan and Germany with the Marshall Plan. That was by design, is what I'm saying. Yet, Japan's household consumption at roughly 55% of gross domestic product is much higher than China's, which is an abnormally low 33%, says Yaxing Huang, professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. So what he's saying is, there's not enough savings going on in China. There's not enough internal domestic capital accumulation inside the country. By comparison, U.S. household consumption climbed to 67% of GDP at the height of Americans' unsustainable spending binge. That means Americans were buying 67% of the gross domestic product, or providing that. They represented that much of the U.S. gross domestic product. Why is Chinese household consumption so low, and what can be done to fix it? Mr. Krugman, speaking at a conference in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, pins much of the blame on a threadbare social safety net, which has shrunk even as China has grown richer. Because people have to stop at the bank on their way to the hospital, they build up precautionary savings at the expense of consumption, he says. The remedy, something Beijing hold on, has already belatedly woken up to, is to reestablish a credible safety net. Beijing has announced plans to spend $124 billion on basic health insurance and primary clinics. Erecting a safety net, however, may have only a marginal effect on spending, says Mr. Huang. He pins the blame not on high savings, China's household savings rate is normal, he says, but rather on declining incomes, especially in rural areas where 700 million people still live. Oh, pardon me, the Chinese consumption rate is at 33%. Japan's is at 55%. Erecting, oh, pardon me, yeah, now listen to this. Mr. Huang says state-controlled banks have directed money to big enterprises and to infrastructure projects, but neglected the rural enterprises that did so much to improve rural living standards in the 1980s. He advocates a push to increase rural incomes by legalizing microfinance, abolishing the city registration system that prevents migrant workers from receiving social benefits, and accelerating land reform. Two of those three deal with entrepreneurship. It was the China rural land reform, some of the communes actually, that actually the Chinese farming system was way superior to the Russian. Way superior. They provided for more individual work on lots of land in a collective context. Russia tried to do everything in collectives. So that's what's being alluded to. Some of the rural enterprise activity that took place in China in the 1980s. Now listen to this. Andy Rothman, a Shanghai-based economist at CLSA, argues that China's continental-sized economy is easily capable of generating huge internal demand. He points to retail sales that are continuing to grow at roughly 16% a year, partly thanks to government subsidies for the purchase of electronics and white goods. He also argues that the role of exports has been exaggerated, with net exports accounting for only 2% of China's recent growth. Even without them, he believes the economy can comfortably return to growth of 8% or more. Not all Asian countries share China's characteristics. Like China, Vietnam is open, but unlike its gargantuan neighbor, it has consistently run trade deficits. That is because it has imported, manufactured, and high value-added goods until it opened its first refinery last year. Typical of low-income countries, about two-thirds of output goes on household consumption, leaving little room to stimulate domestic demand. People don't have enough money to buy their own goods. And there's not enough entrepreneurs to supply the domestic demand for certain goods. It's a vicious cycle. So you don't have enough scale of business activity to make people wealthy internally. At which point they'll buy a wide variety of goods from abroad, spreading the currency. All kind of business activity will take place. And the people of China will begin to invest, and not just consume, they'll invest in other parts of the world. Not the government, but the people. Now, if you look at, they have in this Financial Times article, they have a 12-month rolling sum to April 2009 of exports in Asian countries. Vietnam, $60.9 billion. It's 3.2%. Or exports as a percentage of GDP is 61.1%. That's a change of 3.2% over a similar period. Thailand down 3.9%. Exports are 72% of GDP. Malaysia, $185.5 billion, down 7.6%. Exports are 82.9% of GDP. Taiwan, 63.9% of GDP. Exports as a percentage of GDP in Singapore, 198.7%. South Korea, 50.5%. China, 28.3%. Any event, you had to have entrepreneurs and consumers in order to reach a certain stage of development. And that's the problem in Harlem. I mean, it's not inappropriate for me to make the analogy. You have a consuming base in Harlem that's using food stamps, and you have businesses that won't accept food stamps. Now, if the government is going to pour capital into Harlem through food stamps provisions, which are being increased under the President Obama administration, use that money to support domestic, and that would mean Harlem area entrepreneurs and consumers. This is ridiculous. That there's no competition for a Costco among the indigenous population of Harlem. All these years, all these empowerment zones, enterprise community has not produced, not just in Harlem, nowhere. You don't have no competitor. You feel me? All right. So, domestic consumption, domestic production, investment abroad, consumption abroad. All right. CedricMuhammad.com, you can read my blog. This is going to happen in parts of Africa too. You can't just, there's not enough people that are going to be hired by digging things out of the earth and selling it abroad. It's not going to work. That's another book I'm working on. That'll be the second book.